The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
This morning, Florida in freefall.
Every day it seems like another record.
120 deaths reported Thursday, a new daily high, pushing Florida's fatalities beyond 4,000 from COVID-19. ICU bed capacity in Miami-Dade County, the nation's new epicenter, now at nearly 92% and rising.
We're full. If you come through the ER right now, and when you're admitted, somebody has to figure out where's that bed going to be.
While sending around 100 nurses to Miami-Dade to provide backup, state data shows nearly half of Florida's intensive care units are at least 90% full as COVID testing lines bend around blocks. And the nation's top infectious disease expert highlights a harrowing fact.
When you look at California, Arizona, Texas, and Florida, they're accounting for 50% of the new infections.
Back now at this Miami Beach convention testing site, there's a narrative at the moment that most of the people dying in Florida are older. But Miami's mayor says that a third of the city's deaths right now are people under the age of 60.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Well, the markets are set for a week of gains despite worries over increased instances of COVID in some of our biggest states, from Florida all the way to California. The market is anticipating more stimulus coming out of Washington by the end of the month, and that stimulus could be as little as $1 trillion to as high as $3 trillion. Worries over COVID also sent Treasury bond yields lower this week, while tech stocks enter bubble territory. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. John Krinsky from Baycrest Partners joins me at the top of the hour. John sees techs running into a headwind as valuations and prices get stretched. He remains bullish on gold, but believes the markets are vulnerable to a setback here. Keith Barron will also be here to discuss the gold and copper markets, with a nice breakout that we're beginning to see in copper and, of course, gold. Later on in the program, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But first, let's take a look at the events that moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Thanks, Jim. Let's talk about some key stories this week. So just to recap, Monday's advance was sort of a finish on a five-day advance in the S&P 500. The bullish charge on Monday was due to a front-page editorial in one of China's state-run news outlets that basically said a bull market was imminent. This led to a spike higher in China's Shanghai Composite of 5.7% that reverberated around the world. And U.S. stocks were also helped by the non-manufacturing ISM, which increased to 57.1% from 45.4% in May. So anything above 50, that's an expansionary reading, so another good sign that the economy is improving. Amazon was up 5.8% and Tesla was up 13.5% on the day, which pretty much re-emphasized that mega cap and momentum stocks and technology have been leading the charge, while energy, financials, and industrials have been languishing. Now, Monday's charge concluded the five-day advance in the S&P 500, and stocks spent the rest of the week basically consolidating sideways. A key level for the S&P 500 I've been watching is 3150, and I think if the market is able to hold for much longer above that level, it could finally springboard the S&P 500 to a new monthly high to continue the rally that began off the March bottom. The next catalyst towards that end may be guidance from companies during the second quarter earnings season, which is just around the corner. But just know that the mega cap and momentum names are priced for perfection at this point and will need to deliver. The other item giving pause to the V-like recovery in the economy is the low-yielding treasury market, with a 10-year yield that has been wandering lower after the June 8th recent top in stocks. Friday, the yield of the 10-year Treasury hit a low of 0.57% before staging a rally, and the low in the Treasury yield reached 0.49% at the very peak of fear in March when economies were shut down. So it's not that encouraging that investors still continue to flock into securities promising 0.6% annual returns for 10 years. All right, let's turn to some of the more recent news this week. COVID-19 news this week continues to show that the virus is not contained. While many states are seeing exponential rises in positive cases, the steps they are taking to roll back reopening seems to not be phasing the bulls, or maybe it's not even encouraging the bears, possibly because economic data continues to improve. And weekly, we are hearing vaccine news help to kind of balance the fear of COVID-19 gaining ground. This week, Novavax was the sixth potential vaccine producer added to Operation Warp Speed, which is a partnership consisting of the Department of Health, the CDC, FDA, that's Food Drug Administration, Department of Defense, and other federal agencies to accelerate the development, manufacturing, and distribution of a COVID-19 vaccine, therapeutics, and diagnostics, something they call countermeasures. Their aim is basically 300 million doses of a safe vaccine by January 2021. Novavax will receive $1.6 billion from being added to this by the federal government to advance its vaccine candidate, and has joined, like I said, about five other firms: Moderna, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, Merck, and Pfizer in their fight for a preventative measure. One of the therapeutics that we've been hearing good things about since April has been Gilead Sciences' Remdesivir. And news on Friday showed a 62% reduction in the risk of mortality for patients severely ill with COVID-19 compared to just normal care. And it seems whenever vaccine or therapeutic news is released that's positive, it seems to influence the beaten up cyclical and value stocks better than the momentum tech and discretionary names, where largely we've already seen growth kind of priced in. Friday's news from Gilead helped financials move up 3% and energy up 2%, leading the market last I checked around midday. There were a few comments here and there from Fed presidents that were noteworthy and I thought should be mentioned, and did help move the stock market, especially Bullard's comments, but showed how there's just a wide range of opinion between them. So starting off with Atlanta Fed President Bostic shed some caution on the market Tuesday in a Financial Times interview, saying basically economic activity appears to be leveling off due to the spread of COVID-19. And then there's St. Louis Fed President Bullard, who told CNBC Wednesday he was optimistic on the recovery, which helped boost the S&P 500, which was, I think, trading flat at the time, to close up 0.8%. So Dallas Fed President Robert Kaplan was another Fed open mouth speaker who basically said that growth in the third quarter and fourth quarter following steep drop in the second quarter should expect to see some growth. So, and he also said that he doesn't expect inflation to be a concern for a while. So all the stories haven't really moved the needle up or down for the bears or the bulls. It was a week of consolidation after a five-day advance in stocks. That best describes it. Economic data continues to be constructive, like I mentioned about the non-manufacturing ISM report, and jobless claims continues to decelerate. It's still elevated, but has dropped from the previous week. But recent efforts to curb the growth of COVID will eventually be felt soon in the delayed data, but the stock market so far has taken that stride, even with news from Hong Kong this week that they plan to close schools again next Monday. But as I said, earnings are around the corner, and we'll finally get to hear from management if they have an outlook at all. Many did not back in April when we were talking about first quarter earnings and guidance for second quarter. And that's going to start off with Pepsi on Monday morning, and then Citigroup, JP Morgan, and Wells Fargo will announce Tuesday morning. I'm also interested in hearing from United Health on Wednesday, just obviously with everything that's going on with COVID-19, how that's impacting the healthcare industry. And then, of course, Netflix, with its price raise this week from Goldman, will announce on Thursday. So I'm very interested to see, is it in fact priced for perfection, or due to quarantining, have they seen substantial growth? We'll have to see. So that should be exciting to discuss all that next week. Looking forward to it. But Jim, back to you and the technical report with Jonathan Kritsky.
After 25 years of being in the disinflation or deflationary camp, the noted financial historian and professor Russell Napier has now made a big U-turn in his outlook based on what he says is a regime change on the money creation process, not just in the U.S. economy, but in other major developed economies around the world. Because of this, Russell Napier is now warning that higher inflation is likely ahead of us. Here's what he told listeners on FS Insider this week.
The change in opinion is because there's a change in facts, and that change in facts is the way that money is created. I call it a silent revolution. It shouldn't be a silent revolution. It should be pretty obvious, but I think the markets have missed it. And the reason they've missed it is that central bankers have been doing extreme things. I would call those kind of monetary pyrotechnics. And that has distracted attention from what is really going on here. So here's the monetary revolution. Money, really for a few hundred years now, is not fundamentally created by central banks, it's created by commercial banks. And central bankers try to steer them with interest rates, with provision of reserves, with changing capital adequacy rules to create money. And they failed to do so over the last 12 years. So the governments have stepped in, and so unbeknownst to most people, the power to create money has moved from central bankers to governments. That's what I call a silent revolution. Now, it won't stay silent for long. And given that, and given the proclivity of politicians to print too much money and create too much money, we should now be betting on inflation, even if the near-term outlook is for lower inflation or even deflation. The change in that mechanism is powerful enough that the markets will soon begin to price in higher inflation.
This was a fascinating interview with one of the leading financial historians of our day, where he not only gives the outlook for why he thinks inflation is going to be going up in the years ahead, but also what he believes are the clear investment implications of this when we think about stocks, bonds, commodities, gold, and even real estate. If you want to hear this full interview with Professor Napier, in addition to our other interviews airing 3 days every week on FS Insider, just go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
Are you tired of earning a minimal interest rate on your investments? Are you looking for a higher rate of return on your money? Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Well, tech seems to be on fire and unstoppable. It's been almost a one-way street since the beginning of the year. Will that come to an end, or will this trend continue? Let's find out. Joining me on the program is Jonathan Krinsky from Baycrest Partners. Jonathan, one of the things that I look and see, I'd like to get your comments, is the divergence between what we're seeing in the Dow compared to the NASDAQ and the S&P, which are all above their moving averages.
Yeah, Jim, it's pretty remarkable dispersion going on. And it's something that was somewhat prevalent heading into the beginning of the year and then actually has accelerated the COVID pandemic. So there's obviously fundamental reasons going on behind it. But I think now it's getting to a point, in our view, it's not really sustainable. You look at kind of the sector makeup on a year-to-date basis, there's only three sectors that are up on the year. That's obviously technology, up about 18%. Consumer discretionary 12%, which a bulk of that is Amazon, as we know. And then communication services are up 3.5%. And those are include now Facebook and Google and some of those names. So what we did, we actually looked at, you know, kind of a real composite of what most people view as tech stocks. You know, the sectors define names like Google and Amazon and Facebook not as technology. I think we'd all agree that those are essentially technology companies. And when you do that, you actually get a makeup of around 37% of the S&P. That's kind of what a broad base view of technology stocks make up. So yeah, as you said, it's really remarkable. You have those stocks that are working, and they're really working. Many of them are very stretched. And then you have the more cyclical value stocks, whatever you want to call them, the real economy, reopen stocks, the banks, the industrials, energy, those sort of names that we talked about, just can't really get anything going. They had a little bounce off the lows in March, and really have just gone sideways. So I think that's the big question is, you know, how and when does this divergence resolve itself?
Yeah, and going back to some of the oldest technical theories, the Dow theory, you've got Dow, industrials, and the transports, both in a negative trend. But the other thing I find rather interesting is, Jonathan, I'd like to get your thoughts on this. When you look at the groups that make up the S&P, consumer staples, energy, financials, industrials, utilities, real estate, all in a downturn. On the upside, tech, communications, healthcare, and materials. And there's a little bit of thought on Wall Street that there's this divergence between what is going on in the real economy and what's going on in the market. And it seems like these groups that are in a downturn reflect more of what is actually going on in the economy.
Yeah, that's one way to put it. And then the other thesis is that the economy and what matters is shifting, right? As people adopt more of a work from home view of the market, those stocks that benefit from that are actually accelerating, and we're reliant less on some of the more traditional cyclical areas of the market. But, you know, again, that all is well and known. I think everybody knows that. So now it's a question of how much is priced in. Has it gone too far? And one of the things we just looked at yesterday actually was, if you look at a ratio of the NASDAQ 100, the NDX relative to the S&P, the 20-day rate of change in that ratio, in other words, the NASDAQ relative to the S&P, hit about 9% as of yesterday. So basically that means NDX has outperformed the S&P by 9% over the last 20 trading days. And that is about as wide of a spread over that time frame as we've seen in the last two decades. The only thing that comes close was at the lows in March. So we haven't seen it with the NDX at a high since the late 90s. So again, the question is, you know, do you look at the last 20 years and say, okay, this is very, you know, this is in the top 0.1 percentile of all readings, and you want to start to look for this to fade, or do you continue to ride the momentum? And you know, the thesis there would be that we saw much bigger spreads and divergences in the late 90s. And even several years before the ultimate peak in 2000. So I think that's the conundrum right now. You know, I don't know if we're at a long-term inflection, but I do think, over the next few weeks as we head into earnings season, you know, we could be at a bit of a near-term inflection. And it just seems like a lot of good news is priced in. So even if we get these blowout earnings from a lot of these tech stocks, it seems like the bar is pretty high to actually see the stocks go up on that news.
Jonathan, what could bring this to a halt in terms of technology? I mean, is it going to take some kind of event, or is just somebody going to wake up someday and just say, look, as we head into the fall, you know, I'm up 30, 40, 50% on my tech stocks, time to take money off the table?
Yeah, I think when you get in a situation like this, negative news actually is not what marks the top. You see analysts lowering or downgrading stocks, and the stocks continue to go up on that. You see negative news come out and the stocks continue to go up. So I think in a situation like this, it needs to be something like where you see a blowout number in earnings, right? And the stock gaps up, but then closes down on the day and then goes down again the next day for no reason. And that's almost the more concerning times in the market, when stocks can't go up on good news and people are wondering what's going on. And that tells you that, you know, maybe things are fully valued. So I don't know that it's going to be any negative news or anything. To me, it's when stocks can't go up on good news that's probably the bigger worry. And maybe we'll get some of that as we head into earnings season in the next couple of weeks.
Let me ask you this. As we head into the fall, this is one of the more key elections that we've seen in this country in probably at least my lifetime. Big contrast between what both sides believe in. How much of an influence will the elections have on the markets this fall? Because typically, Jonathan, September and October tend to be a little bit more volatile, rocky months. We've seen some major corrections during this period. What about this year when we're in the midst of an election?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, first of all, as a technical analyst, we try not to look too much at the news. We look more to the reaction. Market's reaction to the news. So we'll have to see. But I think if the last election told us anything, it's that predictions for politics are really pretty much useless. Let's go back to this time in 2016. I think the betting markets had Clinton pretty well odds on to win. And the presumption was that if Trump somehow did win, the markets would crash. And what happened? Not only did Trump win, but the markets actually went really strongly to the upside. So I don't think, even if you told me who was going to win, I don't think anyone necessarily knows how the market's going to react to that. And the markets could be at a completely different place in October heading into that. So, I don't think it makes sense to play that game too early at this point. But yes, September, October do tend to see some volatility. And, you know, again, I think a lot of, given the run we've had, it does seem like a lot of good news is priced into certain areas of the market. But again, that's you could argue the opposite on some of the cyclical areas. One other thing I do want to add, just on a broad base, from a sentiment perspective, one of the things we can look at for sentiment is transactional indicators such as put-call ratios. So it's how many puts are bought relative to calls, or I should say how many puts are traded relative to calls. We don't always know that they're bought. But on an intraday or a single day basis, it's not necessarily all that useful. But when you start to get some longer term moving averages on these, on this data, it can kind of give us a sense of where traders are at as far as their view of the markets. So basically what we have is a 50-day moving average of this equity put call ratio. And that is now down to 0.54. And that is one of the lowest readings we've seen in the last 20 years. We've actually only seen readings that low three other times. Once was in April of 2010, leading into that April peak. We know May 2010 had that flash crash. Then we saw it again in January 2011, which didn't really see much downside. We didn't see much upside either. It kind of chopped around for much of the spring before ultimately rolling over in August. And then the most recently was in February of this year, so right before the COVID pandemic in mid-February. So, it doesn't necessarily mean we have to roll over, but I think it does tell you kind of where people's view is, and they've been buying a lot of calls relative to puts, which is generally more optimistic. And sometimes that can be a contrarian indicator.
So when you take a look at what we're seeing in the market right now, Jonathan, we have the divergence as we began this discussion with the Dow versus, let's say, the NASDAQ and S&P. Now you have the put call, which is almost at extremes, people buying a lot of calls. When you see these kind of diverging events, does it take a number of them to coalesce and then all of a sudden, bingo, you've got your correction or your pivot turning point? What is all of this telling you? It seems to me it's cautionary.
I think it is cautionary. Again, the difficulty is in the timing, as always. I think the market's given a very long time for the cyclical value areas to play catch up to technology and some of the other areas. At the same time, they haven't really fully broken down yet. So even if we look at something like the banks, they're kind of net, they've gone sideways since mid-March. So they have, they've had a couple of decent rallies, but net, they're flat. So they haven't really broken down yet from the March lows, but again, they haven't rallied much either. So, it seems like we're getting a bit long in the tooth though for the cyclical areas to play catch up to the upside. So that leaves the opposite, where you see some of the high price growth stocks play catch up on the downside. And, that I think is the scenario that we're looking for. But again, it's been very difficult to make that bet. And even today, we had a little bit of, we're talking on Thursday here. We had a little bit of selling in the NASDAQ in the morning, and then it just bounces right back in the afternoon. So again, I think that's the setup there. The rubber band is stretched. The NASDAQ is about as far away from its 200-day moving average as it's been since 2000. It's about 22.5% above its 200-day. So, again, the setup is there. It doesn't mean it'll happen, but to your point, I do think there are cautionary signals out there. It's just a matter of, if they play out.
And what's the alternative? Usually, sometimes if stocks aren't doing well, you have opportunities in bonds. And that was certainly the case around February in the corporate bond market. But now when you have the Fed intervening in the corporate bond market, normally you'd see widening credit spreads in a recession as we're in now, but that's not happening with the Fed buying. So where else do you go? I'm looking at a 10-year treasury note that's less than 0.7%. What do you do if you're a pension, if you are a 401k program, if you are a retiree or insurance company? Where are you going for returns?
Well, that's a tough question. And that's the argument for equities, I guess. But, you bring up an alternative assets, we could look at precious metals. I know we've talked about that with you before, and I think precious metals, gold, silver, are really in structural bull markets. We expect gold to break out above its all-time highs, above $1,900 an ounce. Silver has begun to show some signs of life, starting to break out and show some relative strength as well. And even the gold miners, I think a lot of people may not know this, but gold miners are actually keeping pace with a lot of a lot of areas of the equity market. You know, they're up, I think, over 40% on the year, if we're looking at the GDX, and, you know, well over a double off their March lows. So there are areas that are not tech that I think still can work and give you some performance. But yeah, it's a difficult investing environment unless you're heavily focused on technology in that area.
So when you see, we're talking about alternatives here, let's talk about the dollar and the gold. The gold is doing very well. Silver seems to be catching up a little bit, and you also have the gold stock. So all three of those together seem to be confirming. Let's talk about some of the other commodities, and let's talk about oil. What's your take on oil here?
You know, so oil had the huge negative move back in April, you know, a lot of eyes on it then. And then since then, it's kind of seen a slow grind higher. You know, we don't see any big trends or moves in oil. I think it's more range bound, you know, probably 30 on the low end and 50 on the high end. And it's right in the middle of that now. So, you know, it's not very interesting to us. I think, you know, if you're talking about the oil equities, the E&Ps, the oil services, you know, that's all the same trade as we've been talking about the banks and restaurants and hotels. You know, it's all the same trade. It's this cyclical value trade. And, you know, I don't know what it's going to take to see those actually regain their footing. They do tend to be more trades, and you can catch some pretty decent moves in them. But, you know, net, a lot of these stocks and sectors are basically flat since mid-March. So, you know, they haven't been great investments. But if you can trade them, there is volatility there.
And let's talk about one other commodity, and that's copper, which just seems to be, I mean, it almost looks like the NASDAQ. If you take a look at where it's been from the March lows, it's just taken off. They call it Dr. Copper. Does that tell you anything?
Yeah, that is interesting. And I do think it's not getting as much attention probably as it should. You know, there also tended to be a correlation between copper and emerging markets, which, you know, that's one area we also didn't talk about. They're starting to perk up a bit. China's had, mainland China's had an amazing rally, starting to break out a bit. So that whole theme does have some weight. And, you know, maybe that's kind of the a bit of a leading in some of the more cyclical areas of the market. But again, part of that is also a large part of emerging markets now is technology. So names like Baba and names like that. So it's not necessarily the materials and energy type of emerging markets that we may have been used to 10 or 20 years ago. It's maybe a new type there. But yeah, copper, I think, is interesting. We'll keep an eye on that and see if it can continue. That would certainly bode well for some of the more cyclical areas and the material sectors of the market.
So, Jonathan, given this, we've got the divergence between the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P, the NASDAQ up just like it's almost like a NASA space launch. It's almost every single day you're seeing Apple break out to new highs. You're seeing the same thing, whether you're looking at Amazon. It's hard to believe many companies now with market caps over $1 trillion. And if they keep going at this rate, we could be seeing $2 trillion market caps. What do you do as an investor when you have all these cautionary signs?
Well, that's the question, and it really depends on your time horizons and risk parameters. But, you know, I do think a lot of the signs out there are sending a bit of a warning sign. Again, you know, markets don't usually crash from the highs, so there's going to be baby steps that things are rolling over before they fully roll over. You know, but if you're a longer term investor, I think it's clear that technology in that area of the market is where things are going. So it's difficult to move away from that too much. So, you know, I think for most people, though, if you can, you know, if you've had a good run in technology, you can maybe trim a little, because I do think that the tactical risk is we see this rubber band snap back the other way at some point. And, you know, again, I think if we're still moving like this to the upside into earnings season, it's going to be very difficult for a lot of these companies to sustain these levels, even if they report blowout numbers. You know, it's, in some ways, maybe it's the opposite of the setup we had in March into April, where, you know, companies were reporting awful numbers, but the stock started to go up because everyone kind of knew that they were going to report bad numbers. So, you know, I think the next couple of weeks will be interesting.
All right. Well, listen, Jonathan, as we close, if our listeners like to follow your work, how could they do so?
Well, if you're an institutional investor, you know, please feel free to contact contact us via BayCrestPartners.com. Otherwise, you can follow me on Twitter at JKrinskyPGA.
All right. Well, Jonathan, as always, thanks for coming on the program. Stay safe and have a great summer.
Thanks. You too, Jim.
While this bounce is huge, based on the market internals, how many stocks are participating in this rally, which there aren't that many, this could be a bear market or a dead cat bounce, which you have to be really concerned about because it really is a handful of stocks driving this market up. The majority of stocks are below their 200-day moving average. They're moving lower. So we've got this flight to U.S. equities from investors around the world. They're piling into healthcare and tech, which are some of the biggest companies, and they're driving the market indexes higher because they're heavily weighted. And it's not good when the market's really just lifting and floating higher, driven by a handful of companies. So we're in this bubble phase, I feel, and bubble, this could continue to rip, you know, higher. You just need to be able to know when to adjust your positions, bring up your protective stops in place, because if and when it does roll over, it could be pretty nasty and pretty quick.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week with some of the best book authors, industry experts, and leading investment strategists from around the globe, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Well, there's no question that 2020 has been a good year for gold investors. Just about everything is up. Gold is up, silver's up, and so are the gold stocks. But what about the other metals? Things like copper, and even things like silver or some of the other base metals. Are they in a bull market, and is there a possibility? Joining me on the program is Keith Barron. He's CEO and founder of Urania Resources. And Keith, let's begin our discussion with copper. If we take a look at copper, it has been going up recently, and typically copper responds to the economy, and even though we're in a recession, both here and globally, copper has been moving up. So I'd like to get your take there.
Well, you know, they refer to copper as Dr. Copper, because usually it is a pretty accurate bellwether of economic activity. In this case, of course, we don't have a lot of economic activity because of the COVID situation. However, China has mostly recovered and they're back to work and they're consuming copper in a big way. And at the other end of the equation, copper production is way down. And why is that? It's because Chile, who is the largest producer of copper, has been hit very, very hard with the COVID. The copper refinery in Antofagasta is shut down. Chuquicamata, one of the largest copper mines in the world, is shut. And it looks like there's going to be a supply crunch here. So that is the reason why the price has recovered past the pre-COVID price, actually, now. And it's doing very well.
You know, Keith, I think we forget sometimes in this modern green world that we're heading to with electric cars, all the electronic devices we have. Let's talk about the use of copper. It's my understanding that we've been running annual supply deficits in copper over the last couple of years. So let's talk about that in terms of supply, not only with those mines in Chile being down, but where are we getting new sources of supply, especially I think somebody told me there's like 130 pounds of copper that's used in a Tesla. So let's talk about where are we going to get the supply in this green new economy we seem to be moving towards?
Well, all these things come together, and it's very, very important to understand this. And certainly, if you're an investor in the metal space, I think you can really potentially profit from this down the road. So if we take the various points in order here, first of all, as you talked about the Tesla and electric cars in general, because of the batteries and the wiring in them, they contain much, much more copper than a gasoline-powered car, approximately three times more. And so these are very, very big users of copper. There's a lot of copper that's used in windmills, to produce electricity. There's a lot of copper used just to wire together all the solar cells in solar arrays out in the desert. The list goes on and on and on. If only a small number, a fraction, maybe a quarter of America adopted electric vehicles, the entire grid, the entire electrical grid in America would have to be redone. This is incredible. So all that wiring would not be able to handle the load and would have to be replaced with heftier stuff. And copper is, well, silver is a better conductor, but it's too darn expensive. So copper is next place, and it is the best conductor. People have tried to use aluminum as a replacement for copper, but it can't take the heat the same way. So we're stuck with copper. And I believe that what we're headed for is a copper renaissance, much like you had with the electrification of America in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900. I think it was back somewhere around maybe 1881, Thomas Edison electrified a whole city block in Manhattan in New York as a publicity stunt. And that was only the start of it. And then, of course, everybody wanted electric lights in their homes, on the streets, everywhere. And you saw huge copper mines come into production, like Bingham Canyon in Utah, like Butte in by Anaconda in Montana, and they specifically filled the supply gap. So we're in a situation now, though, where in the last 10 years, there have only been four significant copper deposits found around the world. And there's a number of them that were found previous decades that have not been activated as mines for various reasons. Some of it's got to do with the price of copper. We need to see a sustained copper price in maybe $4 a pound. Right now it's around $2.70 or so US, and $4 certainly would jumpstart the situation here so that the mining companies can go out and raise the capital for the development. And that's very, very important. You can't get anywhere if the price is not stable, and if the price is very volatile, then the companies get skittish. So in the longer term, we're looking at a very, very bullish situation for copper. And you know, it goes beyond electrical vehicles and green energy. If global warming really does take hold here, everyone in Europe's going to need an air conditioner. And what is a major component of an air conditioner? It's got about 3 pounds of copper in it, each one. That's a tremendous use of copper. And you know, the list just goes on and on and on.
Keith, what about, let's say, engineers, scientists that work at companies, even at Tesla? If you're making a product that requires a lot of a particular resource, whether it's copper, rare earth minerals, and those minerals are in short supply or there's a supply deficit, won't you be thinking about that in terms of how you're going to make your product and what your future production possibilities are if there could be a shortage?
Well, exactly. And for a number of years now, uranium companies have, or uranium users, the utilities, have had offtake agreements with the various uranium companies to take their production. Quite recently, Tesla signed a deal to take the production from one of the lithium companies because they want the lithium for the batteries. And now nobody's doing this yet in the copper space, but I think as the supply crunch gets tighter, and it won't get tight this year because of the industrial activity is down due to the COVID, but it was suspected to go into a deficit worldwide this year. That'll be delayed until 2021, maybe even 2022, but then it's going to start to bite. So I do think you're going to see the big industrial users of copper, maybe some of the utility companies, form alliances or investments in some of the major mining companies. In the last year, we've seen two major copper mines, historic copper mines, Grasberg in Papua New Guinea and Chuquicamata in Chile, both transit from open pit operations to underground. And there's only so much material you can hoist up an underground shaft. So they're going to be constrained for the rest of the their mine life in terms of their production. And we're talking about two of the biggest, historically biggest copper mines ever in the history of the world. So, you know, this is a very serious and true situation. There is no way that we can make up the deficit through scrap and recycling, as much as some of the environmentalists would like to say. We have to have new mine supply.
Keith, what is this going to do for some of the mining companies? They've got to be looking at this. I mean, when you go from surface mining or open pit down to underground mining, it reminds me of what happened to South Africa, where they just basically kept going deeper and deeper to the point where, I don't know, what was it, a couple miles below the Earth's surface, where the temperatures were just incredible. And it gets more expensive to mine when you're going underground versus surface.
That's exactly right. So some of these companies, they're employing a, I would say, a relatively new method in the industry called block caving. And this is where you essentially excavate a hole under the ore body and then let it drop through gravity. And then you pull out the broken ore. It's being used in at Oyu Tolgoi in Mongolia, but it's not working all that well, not as well as expected. It has been used in gold mines successfully. There's a number of projects on the drawing board right now that are hoping that they can use this technique and make profit at it. But it's still, I wouldn't say controversial, but still not that very well studied from an engineering sense. And it's going to take a lot of convincing, I think, for some of the people in this industry to really embrace. For now, most mining operations are conventional open pits.
Keith, what is it about the mining industry compared to, let's say, the oil industry? I mean, if you take a look at oil production 10 years ago before fracking and horizontal drilling, I mean, just take a look at the U.S. We were producing about 5 million barrels a day. Our production was declining each year, and then we went all the way up to 13 million barrels a day because of these sort of advances in technology. Do you see anything that is advancing on the technology front in the mining industry that would enable these companies to extract more minerals?
Well, the block caving would be one thing. Another thing that's been used over the last few years is what's called in situ leaching, and that involves drilling the top of an ore body where it's been oxidized naturally by groundwater and rainwater, and extracting that copper using reagents that are benign to the environment, so that if they escape into the water table, they're not going to pollute wells and cause disasters. So typically what they will have is one well that's drilled down into the ore body, a couple of maybe a dozen feet away from an extraction well. So the injection well is on one side, the extraction well is maybe a dozen feet away, and they have it engineered so that there's a what we call a positive gradient, and the flow is constrained, so it's not going to escape and go into the environment. So there are a couple of companies doing that, not just with copper, uranium. There's a lot of companies using that technique to extract. So this is a hands-free thing. So there's nobody going underground. There's nobody operating equipment underground or anything like that. However, there are constraints on it. It's all got to do with chemistry. So if the ore body doesn't have the right chemistry, it just will not work. There are really no magic bullets out there for the mining business, as fracking was for oil. And people forget that fracking was actually developed first in the 1940s. It just took a long, long time to catch on. But there is nothing on the immediate horizon for ore deposits.
Keith, let's go on to another metal that's doing well. That's gold, which is up between 16-17% this year. Let's talk about gold as well, because they're not finding major gold deposits. One of the largest producers in the world, South Africa, has seen its production decline steadily over the decades. So let's talk about gold. I know you're a believer in peak gold. Let's talk about that, because what do companies do to increase production? The only time I've seen companies increase production is through mining on Wall Street and buying other companies.
Yeah, that's usually the way that they do it. So they issue equity, issue a lot of paper, and go out and buy junior companies, smaller companies, and acquire their assets. There hasn't been a lot of discovery in the last 25, 30 years now. The gold market is scheduled to go into deficit. Well, it's been in deficit for a number of years, but we're going to hit what I refer to as peak gold this year. And that is essentially where we have reached the maximum of gold discovery. And from here on out, it's going to get tougher and tougher and harder and more expensive to find ore bodies and to extract them. The reason being, most of the low-hanging fruit has been found. Most things have been discovered, and there's not a lot of territory left on the planet where we can walk around and go and find more stuff. I read an article actually yesterday that they've discovered more metals on the moon. But it's going to be a long time before anybody's going to mine the moon.
Well, maybe that's Elon Musk's next company.
Oh, maybe, perhaps so. Perhaps so. In any case, the preeminent producer right now is China. So we had a flurry of activity a number of years ago where a lot of small, really from mom and pop size gold mines to kind of intermediate size things went in production, and that is now declining. They were short-lived ore bodies. They've been exhausted, and so we're going to see the gold production from China decline. It's happening everywhere. America's in decline. You know, we saw in the last year Newmont and Barrick get together in Nevada on their gold projects there for synergies between the two. But it's not actually adding to the number of ounces. It's saving money for them just on infrastructure and stuff like that, but it's not finding more ore. And it's a real problem for our industry.
Keith, what do mining companies do when you're in a bull market? You know, oil companies spend a lot of money on increasing production, which we've seen U.S. production go from 5 million barrels to 13. If we're in a gold bull market, some say that we could hit 3, 4, even Wall Street is looking at $3,000 to $5,000 gold, which is surprising. What does a mining company do to tell its shareholders? It's like, they're totally dependent on price if you can't produce more, unless you just buy somebody.
Yeah, well, they're between a rock and a hard place, if you'll forgive the pun. But the average gold mine now is producing gold at less than 1 gram per ton. And, you know, there's a finite limit to this. You always have to leave some of it in the mill. You can't take it all. And even 1 gram per ton is perishingly small. When I started my career back in the 80s, that was all considered waste. And now they're viable ore bodies that are less than 1 gram per ton. So it's a situation now where, gosh, the only way that they can really increase it, these production profiles keep dropping. And reserves that the companies have. Now, under the last bull market we had in gold back in, well, it started around 2001, we saw a lot of companies acquiring ounces for the sake of ounces. They weren't necessarily questioning whether they were going to be economic ounces or even extractable ounces. And then they got into difficulties when the gold price pulled back. These things were found to be uneconomic. There were massive write-downs from a lot of the majors. There were a lot of executives who were fired. And so I actually suspect that we're not going to learn from that experience, and that if the gold price indeed does take off north of $2,000 or even $3,000 per ounce, then the rule book's going to be thrown out the window again. And everyone who has a gold prospect is going to be promoting hard and making money, at least off the markets. The last time this happened, I said that any company with gold in the name is going to do well, even if they're selling golden retrievers or marigolds. So I suspect that that kind of thing is going to come around if we're in a roaring, roaring bull market.
Keith, do you think at some point we can see exploration plays very much like we did in the last decade, where you had a lot of juniors that were doing the exploration? Of course, one of the problems is a lot of these companies got bought out at absurd prices. But could we see an explosion in the junior market like we did in the last decade?
I fully expect it. In fact, I'm planning on it and hoping for it. I run a junior gold and copper exploration right now, a copper exploration company. My former company, Aurelian Resources, went up 10,000%. It was a huge win for the shareholders. It went from about 30 cents to $43. And then it was bought out at a nice price, but at $60 in the ground, $60 Canadian per ounce. And, today you would never, ever contemplate selling gold reserves, potentially economic reserves in the ground or resources in the ground at that kind of a price. So we are already starting to see a resurgence of exploration. However, even in the last 10 years, there are a lot of places around the world that have been shut out from the exploration companies, new national parks, or just places where it has become just too darn difficult to operate. And so the companies are avoiding them and going after places where there's potentially greener pastures.
All right. So it looks like for precious metals or even base metals like copper, it looks like a bright future in the days ahead. Keith, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out about your own company, Aurania, why don't you give out your website and tell them how they can get more information?
Well, thanks, Jim. There's a ton of information on our website. It's aurania.com, A-U-R-A-N-I-A.com. And you can contact our company through the website. Anybody who has any questions for me about the company, about the mining business in general, far away, I'm happy to oblige. I may not be able to answer them, but I'll do my best.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the program. All the best, sir. And come back again.
I hope I'll be asked. Thanks very much, Jim. Very enjoyable.
Okay. Thanks so much, Keith. Bye-bye.
Do you dream about throwing out the alarm clock so you can travel, enjoy your hobbies, or just relax? You've worked hard for decades and want to cash in on all that hard work. Now it's time to develop a plan that can help you get there. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today to get your retirement plan started. We can help to make sure you have the income you need to live the lifestyle you want, how to maximize government benefits from Social Security to Medicare, reduce taxes and plan for future inflation, or protect your assets with an estate plan. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's edition of Smart Macro. As always, we are joined today by Financial Sense Wealth Management's CIO, Chris Poplava. So, Chris, I'm really excited to get into some of the things that we're going to discuss today. I know you've got some really good charts that we are going to be sharing with our audience as well, where this interview is posted on Financial Sense. But I want to start off with Russell Napier. He's, of course, a very big name, one of the leading financial historians of our day. And we just spoke with him this week on FS Insider. I know that you had listened to that interview as well. And he just made a huge turn in his outlook, saying that he now believes that we're looking at higher inflation ahead. So after 25 years, he is now calling for inflation. And he made a number of different points when it comes to investment implications. So let's start there because, again, this is Smart Macro. We're talking about big picture trends, how you invest around that.
What are your thoughts from your perspective on this idea that we may be seeing a big turn in the inflationary outlook?
I think Russell's right. And it's not hard to make that call when you look at essentially inflation's at zero. I mean, the year-over-year rate of inflation for the headline CPI is at 0%. A lot of that having to do with the plunge in oil prices. But the difficulty, I spent a lot of time this week analyzing the bond market, because for a lot of our clients, we were fortunate enough to lock in a lot of the amazing yields that were present in March when both stocks and corporate bonds sold off. But the dilemma that we're presented with now, those yields that we were getting have since evaporated. And to give you an idea of just kind of the dichotomy of where we are now versus back in March, in early March, we were able to find A-plus quality corporate bonds ranging anywhere from 2 to 4 year maturities with annualized yields north of 5%. And unfortunately, that buying opportunity was short-lived because we heard that the Federal Reserve was stepping into first the investment-grade corporate bond market and then the high-yield bond market. Listening to your interview, Chris, with Russell Napier, one of the things he mentioned was he sold his long-term treasuries. And if you think about it, investors, there's two sides to every coin. There's risk and there's reward. The more risk you take, the more reward you should be afforded for taking that additional risk and vice versa. And so when you think of bonds, your risk is locking in a coupon, a fixed coupon over a set period when you don't know where interest rates will be or inflation will be. So if you bought a 30-year U.S. Treasury, which is barely over 1.5% or so, and you're locking in your rate of return for 30 years, it is highly likely that inflation over that time frame and even long-term interest rates will be significantly higher over the next 3 decades than where they are today. So even if you just think of, and I had this exercise with a potential client, is I took the entire U.S. yield curve going from 1 month all the way out to 30 years. And just assuming a very low inflation rate of 1%, if you wanted to get a positive real interest rate, you would have to go out at least 20 years in a U.S. Treasury to get a positive real return. Anything below that had a negative real return, which meant that the interest you were receiving was less than the annual inflation rate, which means you'd be losing purchasing power. Now, that's using a conservative 1% annual inflation rate. The current 30-year Treasury right now is 1.33%. So if we used an inflation rate of 1.5%, the entire U.S. yield curve would be producing negative real interest rates. So this really does speak, I think, to how unattractive bonds are, particularly long-term bonds at the current levels. And even, unfortunately, corporate bonds. Corporate bonds, you have to be compensated for default risk, where if you look at a treasury, it's assumed as default risk-free. And the spread that you would be afforded normally has been compressed to where the treasury market's not yielding anything, and now neither is the corporate bond market. So it is a very difficult environment to be in for a portfolio manager, particularly working with a balanced portfolio.
Yeah, and when it came to the bond outlook, like you said, he had sold his U.S. Treasury position. He's not positive on bonds at all. And he had said that one reason for that is because obviously we'd see inflation, if he believes we're going to see inflation increase ahead. But at the same time, the government is going to be doing all that it can to suppress interest rates. And that is what is referred to as financial repression. It has been implemented in periods in the past. So he believes that we're going to see a very heavy-handed use of financial repression, which will hurt bonds. But he did cite some areas that he thinks will benefit in the years ahead. And so he listed U.S. residential real estate, not commercial real estate, but U.S. residential real estate, which I thought was interesting. He also cited gold and precious metals. Also commodities, although he said we could be looking at a whiff of deflation in commodities before we eventually see the trend. And that's a bit trickier there, but he said commodities should benefit as well. And then there are some select areas that he liked in the equity space. He was negative on equities in general, but he said there are companies with high fixed costs that should benefit from a higher inflationary environment where we also see financial repression being implemented at the same time. Any thoughts on any of those various investment implications that he listed?
one of the things I was mentioning to you was the fact that there's no yield. And one of the measures that I take a look at periodically is looking at the relative valuations between asset classes. That helps me identify, you know, what has a more favorable risk reward and where I should be allocating client capital and shifting it between the various asset classes. And one of the ways I do that is a couple of metrics, but one that I like that I think is pretty understandable is looking at the S&P's dividend yield relative to the 10-year treasury. And that kind of tells you from an income perspective, you know, which asset class looks more attractive. And believe it or not, if the current S&P dividend yield relative to the 10-year treasury is roughly higher than where it was at the March 2009 bottom in the stock market. It's not hard to imagine that when interest rates are basically at zero, while there's still a positive dividend yield for the S&P. But at one point back in March, we were pretty close to a 2% spread, where you could get 2% more in income than you could from a 10-year treasury. And to me, this really is almost a bookend to what we saw back in 1980, when interest rates were significantly above the current dividend yield on the S&P at that time. For example, you know, back in 1980, the 10-year treasury had a yield that was more than 10% above the S&P's dividend yield. Now it's at 2% below the S&P's dividend yield, which we saw in March, and that's come off a little bit. So, you know, looking at the relative valuation between stocks and bonds, to me, bonds look very unattractive. And when you look at stocks versus commodities, commodities don't produce any income. So the valuation, relative valuation there is a little bit more tricky. But just looking at the price of the S&P versus the price of commodities clearly shows that even stocks are unattractive relative to commodities in general.
Russell was positive on precious metals in this inflationary environment that he sees moving ahead. You have a chart here. I think it's very interesting, and I want to encourage all of you that are listening to take a look at this chart just to see it for yourself. But it's plotting gold divided by the S&P 500 ratio. So where does this fit into Russell Napier's comments, and then where are things at least in terms of our allocation to gold, silver, precious metals in general?
Sure. You know, one of the things I want to first discuss is the idea that there's, you know, bull and bear markets, and even within bull and bear markets, there's secular bull and bear markets, meaning in secular periods, there's multiple mini bear and bull markets that can occur. But a secular cycle pretty much tends to mean, you know, in what general direction is the asset class moving? And to give you an idea of that, you know, think of the move in the S&P from 1980 to 2000. That was a secular period for stocks that had tremendous performance, while gold and commodities in general during that time frame did not perform well. Conversely, if you look at 2000 through, let's say, 2013, that was a period where stocks essentially went nowhere, while commodities had a very strong run, particularly precious metals. And so the idea is that there are long-term periods in which there's a regime shift, which is represented by secular cycles. And that's where paper assets like stocks and bonds can outperform or underperform real assets. Think of commodities, real estate, things that are tangible versus things that are more paper. And if you can identify these periods, the return difference between real assets and paper assets is very significant. And I did some work today to kind of discuss this, and why I think this is a timely discussion is we recently saw a break in the ratio of the price of gold relative to the price of the S&P. And I think we are entering a regime in which real hard assets like real estate, commodities, are going to be outperforming not only stocks, but also outperforming fixed income and bonds. And so what I did is I looked at the ratio and just looked at the trend over the gold S&P ratio going all the way back to the Great Depression and identifying trends and when those trends were broken to identify secular periods. And what I did was I looked at what the price of gold did as well as S&P 500 from the starting point of that trend break to this end point of which we started a new trend. And for example, you know, one bullish period for gold relative to the S&P was during the Great Depression. So from late 1929 to late 1942, the total return for gold was 64%, while the S&P was down 61%. So if you think of it just from an asset allocation standpoint, gold outperformed the S&P by 125% during that time period. Now, if we look at 1942 all the way to the latter part of the 1960s, that was a period where paper assets did well, bonds did well, and stocks did well. And during that time frame, gold was up 21%, while the S&P's total return was up 1,013%. So during this period, the S&P outperformed gold by 992%. Now, in the 70s, we had a very strong inflationary environment. And so from early 1969 to the early part of the 1980s, gold had a reverse of the prior secular period. Gold was up 1,031%, while the S&P was up 44% when you factor in dividends. So that was a short period in which gold outperformed the S&P by 987%.
Interestingly enough, Russell Napier is drawing a parallel to that 1970s period in terms of the level of inflation rates. So just to put that in context for our listeners, that's the period in particular that he's drawing attention to that he thinks we should be mindful of in the years ahead.
I would tend to agree with him. I don't know if inflation will be that high. It very well could. Another analogy that I'm drawing is the 2000s. In the 2000s, the U.S. had surging deficits because of 9/11 and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that put the U.S. dollar on weak footing. I think we're going to have the same situation in which we have massive deficits because of not only COVID, but with the Trump tax stimulus plan in 2016, as well as the entitlement spending that we have ahead of us with Medicare and Social Security. I think we're going to have a wave of mounting fiscal pressure in the U.S., which could lead to a period in which the dollar is weak relative to other currencies and lead to stronger commodity prices. So I think both periods are good analogies, either the 70s or the 2000s. But in both, you know, whether we have a high inflationary environment or more of a mild inflationary environment, I do see hard assets like gold outperforming paper assets like the S&P.
So, Chris, you went through some of these secular periods where we see these changes. In general, what is the outperformance of precious metals or gold relative to financial assets during those periods?
If we just looked at gold versus the S&P, when we see that gold is in a secular bull market, the average performance over those periods is 460% in terms of total return. And in terms of annualized, gold outperforms the S&P by 12% annually. Now, when gold is in a bear market and paper assets are outperforming real assets, gold has underperformed the S&P by 560%, which works out to, over the time period, an annualized yield of negative 12%. So, you know, whether we're in a bullish secular period or bearish, we're looking at a 12% differential annualized return between S&P and gold. So you can see why literally just understanding what regime we're in, whether we should be bullish gold or bullish stocks, can really impact your performance for your portfolio over the long term.
Okay, so you definitely want to be aware of these regime changes. And again, I think that this chart that you've put together really illustrates this very well. So I want to encourage everyone to take a look at that. Looking at the gold S&P 500 ratio. As we wrap things up here, Chris, would you mind explaining Financial Sense Wealth Management's position to the stock market, the gold market, any exposure that we have to these areas? As you had discussed with us 2 weeks ago, we were reducing risk to the stock market given some of the uncertainties, higher levels of risk that we were facing going into the summer and later in the fall. Where does that stand currently?
Well, you know, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, we did reduce our equity allocation, and that decision was made because of the sizable rally we've had since March, and then the beginning surge that we were seeing in COVID cases across the country. And with the surge in cases, which, you know, the consensus was that we would have a decrease over the summer, we felt it was prudent to take some chips off the table, which we have. So we are underweight equities at this point. You know, essentially the market's going sideways. It could go either way. It could head south if we have a further expansion in COVID cases that look like they're starting to get out of control in certain areas. Or it can the S&P can take off if we have further positive data on vaccines or medical treatments for combating COVID. But, you know, so that's why we're a little bit of a wait and see approach with equities. But we are underweight our fixed income. As mentioned, fixed income in general is very unattractive. And we've done that with the expense of moving that allocation towards physical commodities like gold and silver. So we do have exposure to gold and silver as one area that we are very, bullish on over the coming years for the reasons we cited here. And it's an area where we might add even further by looking at commodity producing stocks.
Well, Chris, if any of our listeners want to get in touch with you to discuss anything that was brought up today or to find out more on how Financial Sense Wealth Management can assist them with their investment needs, can you tell them the best way to do so?
They can reach me at 888-486-3939, or they can email me at chris.paplava@financialsense.com.
So again, that number is 888-486-3939, and you can also go to our website, financialsense.com, and hit where it says Contact Us as well. That concludes today's edition of Financial Sense News Hour. As always, if you have any questions or feedback for us based on today's show, you can go to our website, financialsense.com, and hit the Contact Us button, or email me directly at cris@financialsense.com. If you are not a subscriber to our premium weekday podcast called FS Insider, where we speak to a long list of investment strategists, book authors, and industry experts from around the globe, including our recent interview with the noted financial historian Russell Napier, all you have to do is go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense News Hour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.